9th of 1933 of a ratifying act at 12 U.S.C. 95B. The present law forbids member banks of the Federal Reserve System to transact banking business, except under regulations of the Secretary of the Treasury, during an emergency proclaimed by the President, 12 U.S.C. Section 95. We also find in Exhibit 43 that they also had authority to issue license to other things. Under the Agricultural Adjustment Act, we find that they were authorized to issue license permitting processors, associations of producers, and others to engage in the handling in the current interstate and foreign commerce of any agricultural commodity or product thereof, or any competing commodity. Here we see the licensing of agriculture. As we go on through the first 100 days, we can find the licensing and the takeover of industry after industry. We should also keep in mind that at the William Begley, we said that all contracts with the enemies became null and void. If that be the case, we should find some place in the statute where it says that those contracts we had with the Federal Reserve banks, in which they were required to return our gold, would have to be voided. If we go to H.G.R. 192 of June the 5th of 1933, we can read that every provision contained in or made with respect to any obligation which purports to give the obligee a right to require payment in gold or a particular kind of coin or currency or an amount of money of the United States measured thereby is declared to be against the public policy, and no such provision shall be contained in or made with respect to any obligation hereafter incurred. So here we see for the contract were abrogated on June 5th of 1933. Now let's go to Exhibit 45. We see the takeover of the money, the titles, and the property on March the 9th of 1933. But let's read from Roosevelt's papers. It says, this conference of 50 farm leaders met on March the 10th of 1933. They agreed on recommendations for a bill, which were presented to me at the White House on March the 11th by a committee of the conference, who requested me to call upon the Congress for the same broad powers to meet the emergency in agriculture as I had requested for solving the banking crisis. What was that broad power that was used for the banking crisis? That was the war power. We now see Roosevelt saying he is being asked to use this same war power to control agriculture. He says, 3 days later, I sent the proposed bill, which had been drafted in accordance with the recommendations of the conference. That was the bill that Congressman Beck was talking of when he said, if this bill becomes a law, if it happily becomes a law, there will be no Constitution. That bill passed by a vote of more than 3-1. Exhibit 46, if we look at the beginning of the Agricultural Adjustment Act, it says that the present acute economic emergency, being in part the consequence of a severe and increasing disparity between the prices of agriculture and other commodities, which disparity has largely destroyed the purchasing powers of farmers for industrial products, has broken down the ordered exchange of commodities, and has seriously impaired the agricultural assets supporting the national credit structure. It is hereby declared that these conditions in the basic industry of agriculture have affected transactions in agricultural commodities with a national public interest, have burdened and obstructed the normal currents of commerce in such commodities, and has rendered imperative the immediate enactment of Title I of this Act. So we see two or three key things. Number one, the emergency continued over agriculture. And number two, that the agricultural assets supported the national credit structure. All those millions of acres of farmlands, those securities which were necessary to create the emergency currency. And also we see that now agriculture had a national public interest. It was impressed into the public service under this extraordinary time of crisis. That is the war power. And at 47, of this Agricultural Adjustment Act, Exhibit 47, we see it is hereby declared to be the policy of Congress. So we see it's not according to law, is it? It's now according to the policy, the public policy. If we go back to Exhibit 24, and we see, but in defining the meaning of the term enemy's property, we will be led into error if we refer to Fleda or Lord Coke for the definitions of the word enemy. It is a technical phrase peculiar to prize courts and depends upon principles of public policy as distinguished from the common law. So you see that once the emergency is declared, the law is abolished. And we now go under what is called the public policy, whereby we fall under the will, the total authoritarian will of the legislators. It is simply public policy. It is color of law in contradistinction from the law. Exhibit 48, 93-549. Under this procedure, we retain government by law. Special, temporary law perhaps, but law nonetheless. The public may know the extent and the limitations of the powers that can be asserted, and persons affected may be informed from the statute of their rights and their duties. The emergency war powers. 93-549, we find the discussion. And Mr. Katzenbaum, it says, my recollection is that almost every executive order ever issued straddles on several grounds, but it almost always includes the Trading with the Enemy Act, because the language of that act is so broad it would justify almost anything. Then Justice Clark says, most difficult from the standpoint of standing to sue. Speaking of what do the people do about it? He says, the court, you might say, has enlarged the standing rule in favor of the litigant, but I don't think it has reached a point presently that would permit many such cases to be litigated to the merits. Then Senator Church says, what you are saying, then, is that if Congress doesn't act to standardize, restrict, or eliminate the emergency powers, that no one else is very likely to get a standing in court to contest. There is no standi, persona standi in judicio. No personal standing to bring an action in court. Now we've seen the takeover of the banks and the finance and the money. We've seen the takeover of agriculture. And from 93-549, we find that the interesting aspect of the legislation concerning the Agricultural Adjustment Act is the fact that it created a permanent agency designed to eradicate an emergency condition in the severe of agriculture. So we see here now it is contemplated that this thing was not created simply as a temporary measure, that there were implementations that this could be a permanent condition. If that be the case, and we know what now is the case at Title 12 U.S.C. 95B, to this day, 1994, still under that emergency, that if that be the case and we go to 93-549, we can understand what the congressmen were talking about. They said if the president can create crimes by fiat and without congressional approval, our system is not much different from that of the communist, which allegedly threatens our existence. That we have a government that can do anything it wants to, and has for over 60 years. On that same page, we see the language they use, the enormous scope of powers, a time bomb. This is the language our congressmen were talking about. Let's go to Title 3 of the Agricultural Adjustment Act, and we know that our Constitution at the 10th Amendment says the powers not delegated to the United States by this Constitution, they don't have. If we don't specifically delegate the powers to the federal government, they're reserved to the states and the people respectively. And we know that Article 1, Section 10 says Congress shall have the power to coin the money and regulate the value thereof. But if we go to Title III of the Agricultural Adjustment Act, and we read, financing and exercising power conferred by Section 8 of Article 1 of the Constitution to coin money and regulate the value thereof. And we find this power being delegated from Congress to whenever the President finds upon investigation that the foreign commerce of the United States is adversely affected by reason of the depreciation of the value of the currency of any other government or governments in relation to the present standard of the value of gold, or that an expansion of credit is necessary to secure by international agreement a stabilization at proper levels of the currencies of various governments, the President is authorized in his discretion. At Exhibit 23, to direct the Secretary of the Treasury to cause to be issued in such amount or amounts as he may from time to time order United States notes as provided in an act entitled An Act to Authorize the Issue of United States Notes and for the Redemption of Funding Thereof and for the Funding of the Floating Debt of the United States, approved February the 25th, 1862, an act supplementary thereto and amendatory thereof. We see conferring the powers to the Executive. Under the Civil War Act, the War Powers of February the 25th, 1862. And we must realize that Abraham Lincoln, when he was inaugurated president, didn't even have a Congress for over 6 weeks. He declared war. He issued money. He suspended the habeas corpus. He done all of those things as an absolute constitutional dictator. Had he done those without even having a Congress. But when Congress came back into session, realizing that there needed to be some approval, they said that the actions, rules, regulations issued by the President heretofore or hereafter are hereby approved and confirmed. The language of Section 5B as amended and the language of Title 12 U.S.C. 95B came from those acts of Congress of February the 25th, 1862. Whereby the Congress done the same thing in approving the actions of Abraham Lincoln. So now we say, well, what do we do? We find that the terminations of these actions are contained, like in the Agricultural Adjustment Act, Exhibit 54. It says, this title shall cease to be in effect whenever the President finds and proclaims that the national economic emergency in relation to agriculture has been ended. And as we go through all these acts, we find that it terminates by presidential proclamation. And the Congress talks about this in 93-549. They say, furthermore, it would be a largely futile task unless we have the President's active cooperation and support. Having delegated this authority to the President in ways that permit him to determine how long it shall continue simply through the device of keeping emergency declarations alive, we now find ourselves in a position where we cannot reclaim the power without the President's acquiescence. We are unable to terminate these declarations without the President's signature. And we need a large measure of presidential cooperation. And that is one problem. So here we see that Congress is saying that without the President's acquiescence, that they don't think they have the power to terminate. And then the concern about that in Exhibit 56, we see Senator Church saying that these powers, if exercised, would confer upon the President total authority to do anything he pleases. If we go to Exhibit 57, 93-549, Senator Church, like a loaded gun lying around the House, the plethora of delegated authority and institutions to meet almost every kind of conceivable crisis stand ready for use for purposes other than their original intention. He goes on and says that nor is it sufficient if this power be conferred upon good men, for men are frail and easily corrupted. And then in a short time, he that is absolute may easily corrupt the people. Exhibit 58. As a consequence, a national emergency is now a practical necessity in order to carry out what has become the regular and normal methods of governmental action. What were intended by Congress is delegations of power to be used only in the most extreme situations and for the most limited durations have become everyday powers, and a state of emergency has become a permanent condition. Department of Justice. So here we see that these conditions are well recognized. If we go to the Supreme Court, 1935, in United States versus Butler, the Supreme Court overturned these emergency powers. They said a tax, in the general understanding and in the strict constitutional sense, is an exaction for the support of government. This term does not connote the expropriation of money from one group to be expended for another as a necessary means in a plan of regulation, such as the plan for regulating agricultural production set up in the Agricultural Adjustment Act. They said the regulation of the farmer's activities under the statute, though informed subject to his own will, is in fact coercion. Through economic pressure, his right of choice is illusory. Even if the farmer's consent were purely voluntary, the act would stand no better. At best, it is a scheme for purchasing with federal funds submission to federal regulation of a subject reserved to the states. And in Exhibit 61, if the novel view of the General Welfare Clause now advanced in support of the tax were accepted, that clause would not only enable Congress to supplant the states in the regulation of agriculture and all other industries as well, but would furnish the means whereby all the other provisions of the Constitution, sedulously framed to define and limit the powers of the United States and preserve the powers of the states, could be broken down, the independence of the individual states obliterated, and the United States converted into a central government, exercising uncontrolled police power throughout the Union, superseding all local controls over local concerns. 1935, the Supreme Court struck down the emergency powers. But if we remember our history, President Roosevelt immediately went to work to stack the court. Through death and resignation, by 1937, the court was stacked, and these cases were again overturned. As a result of that, we've been under those emergency powers to this day, 1994. The court is now saying that the existence of war and the restoration of peace are to be determined by the political department of the government. And such determination is binding and conclusive upon the courts, and deprives the courts of the power of hearing proof and determining as a question of fact either that war exists or has ceased to exist. The courts says it's not their call to make, that it's a political question. And once the condition has been determined by Congress, then the courts simply recognize that. At Exhibit 63, when the sovereign authority shall choose to bring it into operation, speaking of the emergency powers, the judicial department must give effect to its will. But until that will shall be expressed, no power of condemnation can exist in the courts. Again, the courts are saying that it's a political question. Exhibit 64, 93-549. Just how effective a limitation on crisis action this makes the court is hard to say. In light of the recent war, the court today would seem to be a fairly harmless observer of the emergency activities of the President and Congress. It is highly unlikely that the separation of powers and the Tenth Amendment will be called upon again to hamstring the efforts of the government to deal resolutely with a serious national emergency. If we go on with Exhibit 64, we can then begin to realize what has happened. It says, organizationally, in dealing with the Depression, it was Roosevelt's general policy to assign new emergency functions to newly created emergency agencies rather than the already existing departments. So from that declaration of emergency, we've seen the ballooning of the federal bureaucracy, the creation of multitudes upon multitudes of emergency agencies with emergency functions to rule by statute in all cases whatsoever. The Constitution and the change of that Constitution had been suspended, and there was no limitations upon the power of government. It in fact became a central government of uncontrolled police power. But now we find, if we look at the definition of the prize, Exhibit 65, goods taken on land from a public enemy are called booty. And the distinction between a prize and a booty consists in this, that the former is taken at sea and the latter is taken on the land. So we see here there's a difference between the prize and the booty in the fact that the prize is captured on the water where the booty is captured on the land. But now we have to understand an important concept. And if we go to our Constitution, we find that Congress shall have the power to provide and maintain a navy. This is a permanent power that exists and that Congress always had the power to provide the Navy to protect us from invasion. But we have to realize that the military power of the government under our Constitution did not come inland, because it said that Congress also has the power to raise and support the Army, but no appropriations for that purpose shall be greater than a period of 2 years. So we see that the permanent inland military force was the state militias, that the states, being sovereign, independent nation states, had their own armies inland, and that was the militia. And the only time that the federal government could have a standing army was during a time of declared war. So consequently, the permanent prize jurisdiction could not extend inland. The federal jurisdiction could not extend inland in times of peace. If we go to Exhibit 66, we find that should the president desire to utilize the services of the federal courts of the United States in promoting the purpose of military undertaking, since these courts derive their jurisdiction from Congress and do not constitute a part of the military establishment, we must secure from Congress the necessary action to confer such jurisdiction upon said courts. And it says, the laws and usages of war make a distinction between enemy's property captured on the sea and property captured on land. The jurisdiction of the courts of the United States over property captured at sea is held not to attach to property captured on land in the absence of congressional action. So we see that there's no federal judicial power upon captures on the land without specific congressional action. If we now go back to the Act of October the 6th, 1917, in Section 17, we can see where that congressional authority was given over enemy's property inland. And it says that the district courts of the United States are hereby given jurisdiction to make and enter all such rules as to notice and otherwise, and all such orders and decrees, and to issue such process as be necessary and proper in the premises to enforce the provisions of this Act. This is the inland booty congressional authorization to the district courts, the federal district courts, to make these decisions and to make all rules and all process. This occurred in 1917. In 1933, when the American people became the public enemies, then this authority had to be conferred over the people as well. If we go to the Act of June the 19th of 1934, we see the Act to give the Supreme Court of the United States authority to make and publish the rules and actions at law. This was called the Federal Rules of Civil Procedures Act, in conformity with Section 17 of the Act of 1917. This Act and this power was then to be transmitted to Congress and would become effective after it had been transmitted to the Congress. But keep in mind that the Supreme Court turned down these actions in 1935, so the Supreme Court did not transmit this to the Congress. This Act was not transmitted to Congress until 1938. And the letter of transmittal came to the Senate and the House of Representatives at this time. So now we see that the jurisdiction was complete, that in 1938, the Booty jurisdiction, the federal court's authority over the lands under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, was finally transmitted and approved. We can then see some evidence of what this has done in later years. August the 1st, 1972, Executive Order 11677. By virtue of the authority vested in the President by the Constitution and Statutes of the United States, including Section 5B of the Act of October the 6th, 1917, as amended at 12 U.S.C. 95A, we see that at that time, in 1972, the President took authority and placed the price freezes and the grain embargoes over agriculture. It was through these actions that literally hundreds of thousands of farmers were eliminated from the land. This is just only one of the most recent examples. And it says the reason to do this is to protect the domestic economy from the excessive drain of scarce materials and reduce the serious inflationary impact of abnormal foreign demand. So it is hereby ordered. You see the tremendous scope of powers that this gives. On September the 14th, 1976, Congress consequently passed Public Law 94-412. This was an act to terminate certain authorities with respect to national emergencies, and they terminated the existing declared national emergencies. However, if we go to Section 502, the last section of that act, we find the act reads, "The provision of this act shall not apply to the following provisions of law, the powers and authorities conferred thereby, and actions taken thereunder. 1. Section 5B of the Act of October 6, 1917, as amended, 12 U.S.C. 95A. So we see that on October the 6th, with the termination of the national emergencies, the emergency conferred on March the 9th, 1933, under the authority of Section 5B of the Act of October the 6th, 1917, was exempted from that termination. As a result, we continue under that emergency to this day. We now go back to the first document that our forefathers wrote to the Parliament and King of Great Britain. On October the 14th of 1774, 2 years prior to the signing of the Declaration of Independence, we can read, "Whereas, since the close of the last war," and we see here again that our forefathers weren't arguing during the war, but they're saying that once the war ended, the war powers did not terminate. And they go ahead and say that the British Parliament, claiming a power of right to bind the people of America by statute in all cases whatsoever, hath in some cases excessively imposed taxes on them, and in others under various pretenses, but in fact for the purpose of raising a revenue, hath imposed rates and duties payable in these colonies, established a board of commissioners with unconstitutional powers, and extended the jurisdiction of the courts of admiralty, not only for the collecting of the said duties, but for the trial of causes merely arising within the body of a county." We've came full circle, haven't we? We've ended up today, 1994, right back where we started. On October the 14th of 1774, the same conditions are in place. We're under the same bondage, under the old colonial powers, right back where we started. But we have one thing. In our Constitution, we wrote the laws for government. And in Article 3, Section 3 of our Constitution, we said, "Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them, or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. And no person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. Ladies and gentlemen, is the act of March the 9th, 1933, as amended, a treason? This will be for the common law courts to decide. And whether governmental acts of theft of the nation's money, the citizen's property, and American's liberty as an ideal and a reality, which have occurred since 1933 as treason against the people of the United States, as the term is defined in the Constitution of the United States, probably cannot be determined until the Constitution is reestablished.